Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
This podcast is being presented in two parts. You are listening to part one.
First of all, we want to begin by acknowledging that we are on Duwamish land.
How's everybody doing tonight? Sweet. One of the things that I like about this audience is that you knew that tonight's conversation was going to be intimate. So I want to thank the folks who decided to sit in the front rows. Presenters need energy and your energy is good. Can you hear me okay? Okay, sweet. Let me back up a little bit. My name is Davida Ingram, and I'm the Public Engagement Programs Manager at the Central Library. I want to thank Ashley for kicking us off tonight. You may have noticed that we started by acknowledging that we're on Duwamish land. We're trying to make sure that we do that in each and every program. It's part of our commitment to equity and inclusion. And for tonight, you may have noticed that we decided to underscore intellectual freedom. Now, for lay people, that might not be a conversation that always appeals to them, and we decided tonight would be more like a radio podcast. We always live podcast in the auditorium, but we're trying to build a deeper understanding of what it means to think about civil liberties in these changing political times, and this program is part of a roster of programs that we've been doing to help people understand how to come together and to build community at the library. This program is also made possible with support from the Seattle Public Library Foundation. And I also want to thank Intimon for allowing us to connect with Sarah Porkalov, who is also gonna do an opening reading for us. Tonight's program is about how do you bring dynamic thinkers together with library professionals. And Sarah Porkalov is an award-winning solo performer, director, and arts activist. Is anyone in the audience aware that she also closed a one-woman show? We're a very quiet audience. If you are aware, because it's a podcast, you have to clap or make noise. Otherwise, no one will know. What I like about having Sarah here tonight is that arts and library sciences go together. We may not always see them together, but they definitely go together. And I'm delighted that Sarah will be doing a reading. Right after Sarah finishes her reading, we will also have our moderator, David Wright. David Wright hosts Thrilling Tales regularly at the library, and he is a reader services librarian. He teaches at the UW Ice School and reviews books in Seattle and beyond. David will introduce you to our other presenters tonight, but for right now, can we give a warm round of applause for Sarah?
Thank you so much for having me, Seattle Public Library, and Davida specifically for inviting me here. I'd love to start out the evening with a reading of one of my favorite poems from one of my favorite poets. It's called Ladies First. Pamela Peirce yelled, "Ladies first!" pushing in front of the ice cream line. Pamela Peirce yelled, "Ladies first!" grabbing the ketchup at dinner time. Climbing on the morning bus, she'd shove right by all of us, and there'd be a tiff or a fight or a fuss when Pamela Peirce yelled, "Ladies first!" Pamela Peirce screamed, "Ladies first!" when we went off on our jungle trip. Pamela Peirce said her thirst was worse and guzzled our water every sip. And when we got grabbed by that wild, savage band who tied us together and made us all stand in a long line in front of the king of the land, a cannibal known as Fry 'em Up Dan, who sat on his throne in a bib so grand with a lick of his lips and a fork in his hand as he tried to decide who'd be first in the pan. From back of the line, in that shrill voice of hers, Pamela Peirce yelled, "Ladies first!" Some of you might recognize this as a poem by Shel Silverstein. He's one of my favorite poets, somebody that was read to me at nighttime by my parents in my childhood. And this poem is from his collection of poetry. A lot of us know it, Where the Sidewalk Ends. There was a time in my childhood where I was trying to find this book in the library because I didn't own a copy myself, and I couldn't find it. I remember going to my librarian, I was probably 6 years old at the time, and asking her, has everybody taken a Shel Silverstein books? And she was like, oh, well, that's on the banned books list. And I was like, what's that? And I found out that the book had been pulled because of this poem specifically and its references to cannibalism. At that time, at 6 years old, I was a little surprised. I was a budding feminist being raised by my feminist lesbian parents in Anchorage, Alaska. And I thought that people pulling this book for cannibalism made less sense than people pulling it as a potentially feminist propaganda for six-year-olds. When I was younger, growing up in Anchorage, I grew up very poor, and my family and my parents would take me to the library every weekend. I was an only child as well, so they really encouraged me to read. I think mostly to advocate for me spending time by myself so they wouldn't have to entertain me while they worked, but also because they believed that reading helped develop the mind in a way potentially that television didn't. So we would spend our weekends in the library, and at that young age, knowing that I was poor, I had already internalized the ideas that nice things, nice buildings weren't places that I could be, that those weren't places that I was entitled to. And it felt like that the first time I ever walked into the Anchorage Public Library, because it was huge, these huge steps leading up to four floors of things that I felt were not for me. Luckily, my parents took me to the children's section and introduced me to a couple of really lovely librarians. And thanks to them, I was able to really lose myself for hours at a time in this library, moving from Berenstain Bears to The Witch at Blackbird Pond to reading the whole entire series of Anne of Green Gables. When I was a little girl, I consciously modeled myself after Anne of Green Gables, Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice, Jane Eyre, as well. Those were the three literary heroines that I modeled myself after. And I really think, too, that my time in libraries and my parents' passion for reading to me as well is one of the strongest motivating factors for my journey as an artist, why I decided to go into theater. I consider theater to be the medium for storytelling, that storytelling is the primary mode of theater. I am a storyteller, and what is storytelling? But for me, then the collection and articulation of words, ideas, and emotional experiences that we have as individuals, but also experiences that we share as a community. It was really, too, this idea that we don't walk alone in the world as an individual, but that we exist in communities, and that everything we say, everything we do, everything that we think affects everybody around us in ways that we can see and in ways that we couldn't possibly imagine. That was the motivating vehicle for me becoming an artist activist. The idea that I can use my chosen form of art, storytelling / theater, to push for social change, the social change that I am invested in as a woman and as a person of color, but also the social change that I'm invested in as someone who truly believes that as a community, if we want true equity for every single person, one of the first steps towards achieving that equity, or even talking about it, articulating it, or creating action-based solution plans, is we have to look at our history in totality. We have to look at our history that we share immediately with the people close to us, but also our history here in America as Americans. And I think that libraries are an incredible source of information from so many different perspectives about our shared history, about the culture that we have continued to build and perpetuate, and I think as well challenge. And tonight, as we begin to talk about intellectual freedom, which is really the right that every individual has to seek out and pursue and receive information from as many different viewpoints as possible without restriction, it's just really exciting to me. And I'm so thankful to be here to talk from the perspective as an individual artist of how I can use the resources that the library has to activate my specific community, as well as collaborate with as a community gathering place and as a place of engagement for social change. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. We share something in common. When I was really young, we had a 45 recording of Shel Silverstein reading Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout, Who Would Not Take the Garbage Out, and we listened the grooves off that record. We listened to it fast, we listened to it slow, we listened to it every which way. That, and we also had this other 45 of this spooky story about the black velvet ribbons. Anybody remember that story? Yeah, right, exactly. Snip went the ribbon and off came her head, and I told you you'd be sorry. Anyway, so I'm sure many of us share these same childhood experiences, and this is, you know, this is really a temple of story. Together with theater, I think libraries are really a temple of story. I'm going to kind of quickly go through a few slides here. And there's Sarah. We will get to our panel briefly, but first I'm going to talk a little bit in an introductory way, hopefully not too lectury a way, and not a definitive way, but we thought it would be useful to kind of walk around the grounds a little bit of intellectual freedom, what that is, issues that have been raised in libraries, and just kind of lay some things out on the table. And then we will get to some discussion and questions and answers around that. So I'm hoping that our panelists don't hesitate to disagree with anything I say or contradict anything I say. That's all very welcome. But let's begin by defining our terms. What is this intellectual freedom of which we speak? It all really comes back to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which I've put up here. And if it feels remedial to put that up, that ringing reassurance about our freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right of people to peaceably assemble, to petition the government for a redress of grievances, and freedom of religion. If you all are like, yeah, I already know all that, then you're a rarefied group. There was recently an Annenberg study, just came out a couple of weeks ago, and I think 38% of Americans had no idea what any of those rights were that are guaranteed by the First Amendment. Over half of them had no idea that the freedom of speech was one of the rights that they're guaranteed by the Constitution. Over half, I think 53%, did not know that undocumented immigrants have any constitutional rights at all. That's not new. People have always not known things about their government and about their rights, but it does seem to be getting worse, and that does raise concerns in a time when we are supposed to have more information than ever before. It seems very poignant that we seem to know less and less about our rights. It also is a philosophical quandary. If you have a right but don't know you have it, do you really have that right? If you have a right and people with authority over you, even the power of life and death over you, don't know you have that right, do you have that right? So starting with the First Amendment, we get to intellectual freedom. Oh, we'll add in a little Fourth Amendment, which is the amendment that says that the government can't spy on you and just kind of watch what you're doing all the time. They have to have really good reasons and state them ahead of time. We get to intellectual freedom, which is the natural consequence of the right to free speech. If you have the right to speak, to express yourself, then it follows that people have the right to hear and to understand and partake in that. And the freedom of speech in the round is really how we get to intellectual freedom. This here is the American Library Association's definition of it. I think it's a pretty good one. Accords library users the right to seek and receive information on all subjects from all points of view without fear, judgment, or restriction, and without having the subject of one's interest examined or scrutinized by others. The United Nations has a good one, too. You can look that up. I won't get into it. So, the freedom of expression, the right to read, the right to inquiry, the right to privacy about that. That sounds really, really good in practice. Or that sounds really, really good in theory. In practice, it can be very challenging. What we're talking about is safeguarding the rights of people who you don't agree with, the rights of people who you would never even want to associate with, the rights of people to be stupid. That's part of what we're talking about here. Nevertheless, libraries absolutely love intellectual freedom. This is in our blood, and it's not just because we hate the thought of books being banned. Intellectual freedom is why libraries exist. It's why they were brought into existence, literally, at a progressive era, the same one that saw the rise of public education. Libraries, public libraries, were invented to help promote this idea that everybody had a right to think what they wanted to think and have exposure to whatever ideas were there. Every year we celebrate this in terms of banned books, which is a really, really great way to do that because it makes very clear what's at stake. This is not an academic issue. There are books that are banned and challenged in libraries every day all across the country, not to mention the world. But it also crystallizes this because it's easier to express what you stand for when you have something to stand against, like censorship or banned books. Often the real issues are a lot more subtle and inchy, sort of by inches issues. Often issues of censorship don't have to do with removing books from library, but just maybe putting them somewhere else in the library. And then we have the whole raft of issues around the internet and what that brings into libraries and inadvertent viewing, which isn't really about my wanting to control what someone else is doing, but my not wanting to have to see it. That wasn't such a big thing when we had books, and it was all about books, but when it's projected on a screen, that's a different issue. I want to introduce you to this acronym CIPA, the Childhood Internet Protection Act. We'll probably talk a little bit about this, but has anybody here, aside from the people I know have, anybody here heard of the Childhood Internet Protection Act? Well, for those of you who haven't, you actually have your library to thank because we don't abide by it at this library. The Childhood Internet Protection Act was passed by Congress in the early 2000s a few times, and it requires libraries to filter content on computers for minors as well as to monitor the activity of minors on their computers. Now, the way it works is if you don't do that, then you forego a little bit of federal funding. There's this federal funding called E-rate that has to do with how much we pay for internet. And this library, together with many other libraries, said, you know, minors have constitutional rights, so no thank you. You can keep your money. We're not going to do that. We do offer filtering as an option in our children's area, but this was just a bridge too far. And this is one of the ways that libraries every day stand up for intellectual freedom. Another really interesting no thank you that some of you may have seen in the news recently has to do with this librarian right here. I'm not sure how to say her name. I don't know her personally. Liz Phipps Soero, who is a children's librarian in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Did anybody hear about this case? Okay. Well, she a couple of weeks ago received a nice package of books from Melania Trump. They were 10 Dr. Seuss books. The First Lady had sent books to 50 libraries, one in each state, that had been shining examples. And she's an award-winning librarian. She's got a great library, so she was a natural person, I suppose, to receive this. She, in a public letter in Horn Book, which is kind of the thing that all children's librarians read, said, you know, thanks but no thanks. We're a very well-funded library. We have our school has an actual librarian, which isn't actually all that common. We have lots of money. We don't really need the donation. It might be nice if your Secretary of Education would stop taking money from schools that don't have money and stop rewarding places that don't really need the help. And, by the way, Dr. Seuss is kind of old hat and kind of racist. And this, of course, provoked all kinds of controversy on several different fronts. People feel very different ways about this. Some people completely agree with everything she did and said. Some people agree with about half of it. Some people don't agree with any of it, and it's all a mix. I'd be curious to know what our panelists think. But it does bring up one issue that gets raised in libraries a lot that might seem like an odd one to bring up, and that's the issue of neutrality. We will talk about it tonight, but why talk about neutrality? What's the deal with neutrality? Well, library neutrality stems from actually kind of a good place, and that's why I want to sort of be an apologist and explain where it comes from. It has to do with our role as librarians and information providers when we're working in the library and the importance of our being neutral at those times. So we're government workers, And we're here to provide access to all kinds of information. It doesn't matter what you want to know about. We're not here to judge you. We're here to help you to that. So I put up a bunch of buttons here, and you can probably guess which buttons it's okay for a librarian to wear on the desk when they're working with the public, and which ones they better save for their personal life after hours. It's great to, you know, promote books and to say libraries are for everyone, but campaigning for a particular candidate or campaigning even for the bond measure for your own library while you're working in the library is strictly forbidden for very good reasons. That's a kind of library neutrality that most of us can buy into. It makes sense because we're not here to tell you what we think or convince you of any point of view. We're just here to help you find the way to your answers. However, in the larger context, are libraries neutral? Are they neutral in society? Have they ever been neutral? Probably not. There are all kinds of things and all kinds of ways that libraries take stands all the time. I'm throwing up here some pictures of various displays at different libraries, and these may not seem like all that much to you, to us here in Seattle, to see these kinds of displays that are put on by libraries, but when you reflect that many of these are from libraries like Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Birmingham, Alabama, this is a pretty heroic act on the part of some librarians who are really welcoming necessary trouble into their libraries by doing things, sometimes subtle and devious things, like this Star Wars display. I love the Resist the Empire thing. It's about Star Wars. That they will do in their libraries. Libraries have always existed in the world, and we're not, although we're idealistic institutions and we are trying to move towards better things, we are always learning and growing, and we have a long way to go. We are far from perfect. Is probably pretty obvious to all of you, but to those of us who work in libraries, we need to remind ourselves of that. And access is another touch point for libraries. It's very, very crucial if we talk about freedom of information to talk about people's abilities to get that access, which has not always been not something that we've always lived up to. But it's seldom as simple as we think it is. It's not all just about an open door policy. It often has to do with us going out into the community. It also has to do with all kinds of other issues around library fines, around our open hours, around how to best spread around resources in ways that are equitable when we don't really necessarily have all the resources we would like to have. So there are a lot of really tough compromises that go around in libraries every day. I wanted to have a slide here of Richard Kramer, to tell you about Richard Kramer. I quieted the slide because I thought I'd run out of time, but I'll just mention it really briefly because I think I do. Richard Kramer was a homeless individual, that's what we called them in the 90s, who frequented the Morristown, New Jersey Public Library. And the folks of Morristown, New Jersey said, well, you know, you're not real kempt and you're kind of scary and we're not sure what to do with you. You stare at people and so we're going to tell you to go. And he sued and he won in federal court. And it was turned over in Court of Appeals, and it's a long, long story. But as a result of this man, Richard Kramer, libraries defined their way of dealing with people and have striven to do so not based on who you are, which is very, very hard to do, as I'm sure we can appreciate, because there's just a lot of things sort of built into the way we behave that do that. So also talking about access, I mentioned about going beyond the library's walls, and that's also not just something we do now, and these two examples, which is an old bookmobile, and also us just this past year going out with Wi-Fi hotspots to shelters. This is really crucial, too, in terms of intellectual freedom. So what's the point of all this, in summation? The idea of intellectual freedom is to have an informed citizenry. It's for a democracy. How's that working for us? I have concerns. How many people are familiar with the term filter bubble? It's an interesting, yeah. This has to do with the way technology helps us, the way technology treats us like consumers rather than citizens, by showing us just what it thinks we want to see. It's sort of borrowed from retail, and now it's everything. So that means that if you lean left, you don't have to see any of that other stuff. That's fine. We fixed it so that when you search, you'll just see that stuff. Or if you lean right, or however you lean, we're going to tailor your experience so the rest of the world doesn't exist for you. This is a serious issue. Confirmation bias is nothing new. Humans have always been prone to looking for things that basically tell us, you know, that what we think is right. But we have, I think, never before had technology helping us to reaffirm that so well, so that we don't even have to think about it anymore. It's just sort of all done for us. And then media, tailor-made media for your needs. Media, I love this quote, media cannot tell you what to think, but media certainly does tell you what to think about, something maybe we're not always conscious of. And so when librarians get fussy and upset about how easy it is for people to say, oh, you can just Google anything. And who needs librarians? You can just Google anything. It's not that we're jealous of the technology, and it's not that we're Luddites. It's that Google has a responsibility to its shareholders. Libraries have a responsibility to you. It's a huge difference in lots of big and little ways. There are some programs and things that we're trying to do to help counter this. There's a great series of programs at this library and in libraries all over the country specifically designed to help educate people about fake news and how that works. This is my colleague Dejiang out doing that good work, and I think you'll see a lot more things like that as well in the future. But I think that is about all I'm going to say, because I've really said it all, I think. So let's talk. What I want to do now is introduce our panelists and bring them up here, and we're going to launch into some questions that we've prepared for this. And so, let me do so. First of all, let me begin again with Sarah Porcala. Sarah, as you have heard, is an award-winning solo performer, director, arts activist. She is committed to dynamic storytelling, community, and the destruction of white supremacy in America. Next, Becky Use. Becky is the Library Applications and Systems Manager here at the Seattle Public Library. She knows all kinds of amazing stuff about how our tech works. And you can find her online at Twitter at @YO_BJ. And last but certainly not least, we have Susan Hildreth. Susan is an iSchool professor of practice at the University of Washington. iSchool, that's the information school. And she has worked in libraries at local, state, and federal level, including she ran this library for a little while, not too long ago. And she is committed to libraries providing access to information. Welcome, Susan. So what we're going to do is I'm going to field some questions and we'll discuss them. And we'll do that for a while. And then if there's time and if other people here have questions or comments and things that they want to share that are provoked by the discussion or the reading or what have you, we'll do that afterwards. So know that you will have a chance to ask questions and be heard if that's of interest to you. Excellent. So without further ado, let me go ahead and launch into the first question. Is that okay with you all? Okay, cool. Great. Yes, that's right. We have microphones. Okay. So when we look at public figures like the alt-right speaker Milo Yiannopoulos and football player and Black Lives Matter activist Colin Kaepernick, freedom of speech and social justice crops up in different ways. How would you like to see libraries helping people navigate our political moment? And what ways do you see having access to information building more shared ground? Or anything else actually pertaining to kind of freedom of speech and the current situation and thoughts you have on that? Whoever wants to speak first. I don't think we're going to go in order, so.
Whoa, okay. Yes, I will be. Well, first of all, I want to thank David for his amazing kind of journey through the history of intellectual freedom. So David has covered all the points, and it's just, you did a great job, David. I think it was amazing and really helped hopefully get all of us on some common ground. So, you know, it is such a challenging time in our society, in our communities, and I think in terms of what the library can do, and I guess I should share with everybody that I've been around libraries for a long time, and I'm so excited to be on this panel with such a wonderful artist and a great tech person from the library, so I feel like I'm kind of the old school person on here, but I'll try to share some good stories with you. But I think we have a role, libraries have a role in providing curated information from a variety of viewpoints, and we're going to talk about neutrality in a little bit as well, but we're really here to provide both sides, many sides, all sides of a discussion, no matter what the topic is. So it's not neutral as much as making sure that we're covering all the bases. That's not really neutral. But providing this curated information from a variety of viewpoints is important. We want to make sure we're providing accurate information and not fake news. Fake news is a huge topic, and I know we're doing great programming on that in libraries all around the country. There's a lot of information online about fake news that can help you and those around you really acknowledge how we can determine what's appropriate. We also want to be careful and use useful approaches to vetting the validity of information. That's really important. And, you know, the thing that I would like to jump to in terms of this particular question, and then I'll pass it on to my fellow panelists, is that we have an opportunity to provide a venue for civil community conversations in our libraries. Now, we're already doing it here in Seattle, and we do it really all around the country, but that is such an important role for the library to play, particularly when we have lots of different points of view. That access to valid information is very critical, and I hope that the library can serve as a bridge, if you will, for individuals who have many different points of view, but hopefully are willing to try to listen and learn from each other. And libraries and librarians can serve as facilitators in those conversations.
I know we're going to talk a little bit more about the technology part later on in this presentation, but as for the what ways do we see the library helping access to information for various patrons, you have to realize that with the growth in technology in terms of born digital information, how people are sharing information in the past decade and so, where you're having a point where people cannot get ahead or people can't seem to advance in society because they don't have access to certain information or even certain technologies. More and more you have to have access online to do job applications. More and more you have to be online to take courses for job development or continuing education. The library plays a part in making sure that we give equal access to technologies and to information that people might not otherwise have in other venues. And we tend to forget that. For those of us who can't afford a very good data plan with a good carrier that doesn't slow down speeds, that not many people have access to the technology that they need so they can access the information that they might not otherwise have access to, be it freely online or through a paywall. So a good portion of intellectual freedom goes into who has access to what in terms of what publishers decide to do in terms of making sure that they churn a profit and put articles, research behind paywalls that only people who have the funds to pay to go to a certain institution or have the privilege of living in a certain area can have access to because, again, they're well-funded. So in a way, one huge way that the library can help in making sure that we have a common platform for everyone to stand on is making sure everyone has equal access to the technology and the information that is provided by that technology.
So I often find libraries overwhelming because of the wealth of information that is here. Regarding a unified platform for searching, technology has shown us, of course, that it will show us what it thinks we want to see based on a series of algorithms that we have plugged into the computer, and so it shows us what we want to see. And maybe that's not necessarily equal or correct information. So when I ask myself, what can a library do as a place of engagement? For example, if we were to talk about the context, for example, of this alt-right speaker, provide context for his ideology, provide historical information, track really the pedagogy that he is drawing his theories from, I mean, all of that information is present in this library, to talk about how Colin Kaepernick's protest has become misconstrued, and now mainstream media is portraying his taking a knee during the national anthem as a protest of like American patriotic values, and deflecting from his original intent of protesting and amplifying the fact that black unarmed men suffer disproportionately from white police brutality. That the library, as a source and as a place that has a wealth of information, has the opportunity to frame and to provide context depending on who they want to engage with. Now, I think that already sounds a little bit clicky, that it's like, well, if they have the ability to do that, doesn't that mean that they'll only provide context for these people? Are they providing context in equitable ways? And I think that through community programming, for example, to have a conversation, really a dialogue happening between people in the community who can speak, for example, specifically to these two people in this first question. But how can we frame the context of this? Maybe it's a conversation where we have very specifically high school students coming, and we frame it in the context of, all right, so now you have access through technology, and you're seeing how people all over the world are taking a knee, but how this gesture has, through different contexts, taken on different meaning. The library can provide amazing social, political, economic, historical narrative context for that, and in that way provide, I think, a better equitable platform for specific individuals, specific communities, specific organizations.
I'm actually going to join in a little bit because I sat down here with you, and I had a thought, and we were talking about, the media tailoring itself and everybody kind of getting their own version of things and how distressed we are about that, how things seem to be sort of flying apart. And I think we have to be careful not to indulge in sort of some golden ageism, that there was a time when there were only three networks, and there was a time when everybody knew what was true, and we all had one story, and we all believed in it. That's easy for me to think, but I suspect that traditionally marginalized people might say, no. that actually was never the case. You just didn't realize it because the story was your story. We were playing by your rules. It was your paradigm. And now you have perceived that it's not as simple as you thought it was. That is terrifying, I think, for many of us, but not to be Pollyannish, but it also may be an opportunity. There's some new awareness dawning on people who never really perceived that there were maybe different ways of looking at things quite so much. So, all right, question number two. I was calling trivia last night, so I'm a little bit... Libraries are often considered neutral places in the sense that we are nonpartisan. Yet libraries also have core values that mean everyone should have unfettered access to information, that is, intellectual freedom, and that the government should not be dictating what the public access looks like. From the perspective of an artist and layperson, Sarah, and library professionals, Susan, Becky, how do we want to see libraries striking a strategic balance between being for everyone, essentially, while also protecting our civil liberties?
Can you repeat just that last sentence for me, David?
Sure. Thank you. I know. This is from the perspective of an artist and layperson.
Mm-hmm.
How do we want to see libraries striking a strategic balance between being for everyone, essentially, while also protecting our civil liberties?
Mm. That's a hard question for me personally to answer. I take issue with statements such as for everyone, or universal, or everybody has equal access to, only because I can't know for certain that that's true. So then my mind goes to, well, what is the opposition to that question? The opposition would be, well, if I don't have access to this, then my civil liberties are being challenged. It makes me think about intellectual freedom, that you have the right to seek out and receive information from all different viewpoints. So that's, but what will a person then do with that information? And is the institution that provides that information responsible for the actions of that individual? And this is where I get a little, I just have a hard time articulating this, because intellectual freedom all boils down to like individual going out and seeking information and receiving information. But I know and I truly believe that none of us really walk in a vacuum. So any information that we do receive affects how we think, which affects what we say, which affects our behavior, which affects everybody around us. So how can, I think that libraries are for everyone. I think that there are questions of access that I definitely agree with, and I'm not quite sure how to solve for people. And as far as protecting civil liberties or civic liberties, I think that libraries do that. At least I can only speak as a Seattleite in my experience with the libraries here in Seattle. And it's an incredible privilege to be a citizen in this community and have access to this source of information. I'm sorry that I can't articulate further. Sorry, guys.
No worries, because as library professionals, we're having a hard time ourselves. And we've been having a hard time for a very long time. And I'm going to have to push back a little bit, David, on something that you said about the start of the public libraries in the U.S. There has been research and other histories done about the start of the public library systems in the U.S., more as a way to influence the lower classes to become civil. What material should they be reading to become proper? What language should they learn to become integrated into the U.S.? So libraries themselves did not start off at a neutral position. They started off with, many of them started off with a hidden agenda or not so hidden agenda to, not really hidden, not so hidden, a little bit obvious agenda to groom the unwashed masses to become more of those who are in power and in privilege. And there's been one thing I do want to bring up, and this is where I have to state, I am speaking for myself and not for SPL, even though I am speaking in an SPL event. There has been discussions recently in various library publications, research, and so on, about how far does free speech and intellectual freedom have in the library? When do we say this particular idea or this particular type of speech is harmful for the rest of our community? So a good example of this is not a U.S. example. It's a recent example from earlier this year. Toronto Public Library had Nazis go in and hold a memorial ceremony in one of their meeting rooms. And there was a huge protest and backlash from the community, but they still held that particular event. So where do you go with a particular group that has advocated the eradication of another group or the dehumanization of other human beings? Does the library provide space, provide resources for that group in that space? And that comes into the idea of the paradox of tolerance, where you have tolerance taken to a point where you tolerate intolerance, and that intolerance then tears down that tolerant society. Where do libraries sit within the paradox of tolerance? I'll just leave that there.
Wow, that's quite an observation. Are we okay here? You know, this is a very challenging topic, but in response, Becky, to some of your very eloquent thoughts, libraries have been, particularly public libraries, have been struggling with the conflict of openness and tolerance for many years. And I think one of the things we have to remember is that public libraries are publicly funded, tax-supported institutions. So particularly with the meeting room example, which, and there's many of these around the country, it may very well be that members of that Nazi group, I'm not speaking on behalf of their belief system, but they paid taxes just as well as other individuals who may have other beliefs. So it becomes a much more complicated issue, I think, than might appear on the surface. And in fact, many things about what we do in libraries is far more complicated than the general public would imagine. And not that we don't love the general public, but it really makes working in libraries pretty interesting. But just a couple of things I wanted to add. Libraries are community institutions, and it is critical that the library somehow reflects the values of the community. Now, it can be very challenging when a community doesn't have consensus on values, but I think it's also a conversation that the community and the library has to have to make sure the library is somehow in line with its community values. And there's also the challenge of individuals who serve in these capacities, librarians. How do we separate our personal values from what we know as our professional values? And that's always really been a challenge. You know, it's interesting that that dynamic has come into the discussion about the Cambridge librarian that David referred to. Now, I mean, personally, I think she's done a very brave thing by really eloquently calling out this kind of misdirected beneficence from the Department of Education. Yet she had not gotten the counsel of the administration in that school district, and that's not the approach they would have taken. In fact, they said she wasn't authorized to make that response. And I'm saying in that situation, she had personal feelings that she used in a professional way. And that can be a very challenging area for us in the profession.
And I also want to add, going back, providing context for that information and for the decision that she's made and for certain types of materials that are in the library. I come from both a technology background and an organization and information background. So I both enter the information that makes it possible for the system to provide you the search capability of finding that material. And so when you're dealing with material that is either controversial in terms of either being a hoax or some other particular types of materials that might be considered offensive or controversial, how does the person holding the material catalog that book? What subject headings do you put on there? Because subject headings and other information that you put into the system can possibly restrict access to that material. And so librarians and library staff have to be mindful of how they're providing access to these type of materials that they might find objectionable or are hoaxes in a manner that the public can still find them, but in a manner that fully represents that particular topic in context.
You know, if you get the chance to go and read this librarian's open letter in Hornbook, you can look it up, and I do recommend reading it. It's very interesting. It's very polished and sweet with a real sort of dagger's edge in it. She's the model librarian, and she recommends a book list of much more diverse choices to Melania and so forth, and it's really an interesting thing to read and hear how she does that and how she kind of turns the knife. All right, I think I will move on to our next question. I had something else to say, but I forgot what it was, so it wasn't that important.
This concludes part one. Listen to part two for the conclusion of this podcast.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.